He'll be okay? As long as he doesn't try to eat any of those wood chips. I've been splitting stove lengths, Johnny said, setting Denny down as carefully as a Ming vase. Good exercise. How are you, physically? I think, Johnny said, remembering the heave-ho he had given Richard Dees a few days ago, that I'm doing as well as could be expected. That's good. You were kind of low the last time I saw you. Johnny nodded. The operations. Johnny? He glanced at her, and again felt that odd mix of speculation, guilt, and something like anticipation in his viscera. Her eyes were on his face, frankly and openly. Yeah? Do you remember about the wedding ring? He nodded. It was there, where you said it would be. I threw it away. Did you? He was not completely surprised. I threw it away and never mentioned it to Walt. She shook her head. And I don't know why. It's bothered me ever since. Don't let it. They were standing on the steps facing each other. Color had come up in her cheeks, but she didn't drop her eyes. There's something I'd like to finish, she said simply. Something we never had the chance to finish. Sarah, he began and stopped. He had absolutely no idea what to say next. Below them, Denny tottered 6 steps and then sat down hard. He crowed, not put out of countenance at all. Yes, she said. I don't know if it's right or wrong. I love Walt. He's a good man, easy to love. Maybe the one thing I know is a good man from a bad one. Dan, that guy I went with in college, was one of the bad guys. You set my mouth for the other kind, Johnny. Without you, I never could have appreciated Walt for what he is. Sarah, you don't have to. I do have to, Sarah contradicted. Her voice was low and intense. Because things like this you can only say once, and you either get it wrong or right. It's the end either way because it's too hard to ever try to say again. She looked at him pleadingly. Do you understand? Yes, I suppose I do. I love you, Johnny, she said. I never stopped. I've tried to tell myself that it was an act of God that split us up. I don't know. Is a bad hot dog an act of God? Or 2 kids dragging on a back road in the middle of the night? All I want. Her voice had taken on a peculiar flat emphasis that seemed to beat its way into the cool October afternoon like an artisan's small hammer into thin and precious foil. All I want is what was taken from us. Her voice faltered. She looked down. And I want it with all my heart, Johnny. Do you? Yes, he said. He put his arms out and was confused when she shook her head and stepped away. Not in front of Denny, she said. It's stupid, maybe, but that would be a little bit too much like public infidelity. I want everything, Johnny. Her color rose again, and her pretty blush began to feed his own excitement. I want you to hold me and kiss me and love me, she said. Her voice faltered again, nearly broke. I think it's wrong, but I can't help it. It's wrong, but it's right. It's fair. He reached out 1 finger and brushed away a tear that was moving slowly down her cheek. And it's only once, isn't it? She nodded. Once we'll have to put paid to everything. Everything that would have been if things hadn't gone wrong. She looked up, her eyes brighter green than ever, swimming with tears. Can we put paid to everything with only the one time, Johnny? No, he said, smiling. But we can try, Sarah. She looked fondly down at Denny, who was trying to climb up onto the chopping block without much success. He'll sleep, she said. 3. They sat on the porch and watched Denny play in the yard under the high blue sky. There was no hurry, no impatience between them, but there was a growing electricity that they both felt. She had opened her coat and sat on the porch glider in a powder blue wool dress, her ankles crossed, her hair blown carelessly on her shoulders where the wind had spilled it. The blush never really left her face. and high white clouds fled across the sky, west to east. They talked of inconsequential things. There was no hurry. For the first time since he had come out of it, Johnny felt that time was not his enemy. Time had provided them with this little air pocket in exchange for the main flow of which they had been robbed, and it would be here for as long as they needed it. They talked about people who had been married, about a girl from Cleves Mills who had won a merit scholarship, about Maine's independent governor. Sarah said he looked like Lurch on the old Addams Family show, and thought like Herbert Hoover, and they both laughed over that. "Look at him," Sarah said, nodding toward Denny. He was sitting on the grass by Vera Smith's ivy trellis, his thumb in his mouth, looking at them sleepily. She got his car bed out of the Pinto's back seat. "Will he be okay on the porch?" she asked Johnny. "It's so mild. I'd like to have him nap in the fresh air." "He'll be fine on the porch," Johnny said. She set the bed in the shade, popped him into it, and pulled the two blankets up to his chin. "Sleep, baby," Sarah said. He smiled at her and promptly closed his eyes.
"Just like that?" Johnny asked.
"Just like that," she agreed. She stepped close to him and put her arms around his neck. Quite clearly, he could hear the faint rustle of her slip beneath her dress. "I'd like you to kiss me," she said calmly. "I've waited 5 years for you to kiss me again, Johnny." He put his arms around her waist and kissed her gently. Her lips parted. "Oh, Johnny," she said against his neck, "I love you." "I love you too, Sarah." "Where do we go?" she asked, stepping away from him. Her eyes were as clear and dark as emeralds now.
"Where?"
4. He spread the faded army blanket, which was old but clean, on the straw of the second loft. The smell was fragrant and sweet. High above them, there was the mysterious coo and flutter of the barn swallows, and then they settled down again. There was a small, dusty window which looked down on the house and porch. Sarah wiped a clean place on the glass and looked down at Denny.
"It's okay?" Johnny asked.
"Yes. Better here than in the house. That would have been like..." She shrugged. "Making my dad a part of it?"
"Yes. This is between us."
"Our business."
"Our business," she agreed.
She lay on her stomach, her face turned to one side on the faded blanket, her legs bent at the knee. She pushed her shoes off one by one.
"Unzip me, Johnny."
He knelt beside her and pulled the zipper down. The sound was loud in the stillness. Her back was the color of coffee with cream against the whiteness of her slip. He kissed her between the shoulder blades, and she shivered.
"Sarah," he murmured.
"What?"
"I have to tell you something."
"What?"
"The doctor made a mistake during one of those operations and gelded me."
She punched him on the shoulder.
"Same old Johnny," she said.
"And you had a friend once who broke his neck on the crack the whip at Topsham Fair."
"Sure," he said.
Her hand touched him like silk, moving gently up and down.
"It doesn't feel like they did anything terminal to you," she said.
Her luminous eyes searched his.
"Not at all. Shall we look and see?"
There was the sweet smell of the hay. Time spun out. There was the rough feel of the army blanket, the smooth feel of her flesh, the naked reality of her. Sinking into her was like sinking into an old dream that had never been quite forgotten.
"Oh, Johnny, my dear."
Her voice in rising excitement, her hips moving in a quickening tempo. Her voice was far away. The touch of her hair was like fire on his shoulder and chest. He plunged his face deeply into it, losing himself in that dark blonde darkness. Time spinning out in the sweet smell of hay, the rough textured blanket, the sound of the old barn creaking gently like a ship in the October wind, mild white light coming in through the roof chinks, catching motes of chaff in half 100 pencil-thin sunbeams.
motes of chaff dancing and revolving. She cried out. At some point, she cried out his name, again and again and again, like a chant. Her fingers dug into him like spurs, rider and ridden. Old wine decanted at last, a fine vintage. Later, they sat by the window, looking out into the yard. Sarah slipped her dress over her bare flesh and left him for a little bit. He sat alone, not thinking, content to watch her reappear in the window, smaller, and cross the yard to the porch. She bent over the baby bed and readjusted the blankets. She came back, the wind blowing her hair out behind her and tugging playfully at the hem of her dress. "He'll sleep another half hour," she said. "Will he?" Johnny smiled. "Maybe I will, too." She walked her bare toes across his belly. "You better not." And so again, and this time she was on top, almost in an attitude of prayer, her head bent, her hair swinging forward and obscuring her face, slowly. And then it was over. 5. Sarah? "No, Johnny. Better not say it. Time's up. I was going to say you're beautiful." "Am I?" "You are," he said softly. "Dear Sarah." "Did we put paid to everything?" she asked him. Johnny smiled. "Sarah, we did the best we could." 6. Herb didn't seem surprised to see Sarah when he got home from Westbrook. He welcomed her, made much of the baby, and then scolded Sarah for not bringing him down sooner. "He has your color and complexion," Herb said, "and I think he's going to have your eyes when they get done changing." "If only he has his father's brain," Sarah said. She had put an apron on over the blue wool dress. Outside, the sun was going down. Another 20 minutes and it would be dark. "You know, the cooking is supposed to be Johnny's job," Herb said. "Couldn't stop her. She put a gun to my head." "Well, maybe it's all for the best," Herb said. "Everything you make comes out tasting like Franco-American spaghetti." Johnny shied a magazine at him, and Denny laughed a high, piercing sound that seemed to fill the house. "Can he see?" Johnny wondered. "It feels like it's written all over my face." And then a startling thought came to him as he watched his father digging in the entryway closet for a box of Johnny's old toys that he had never let Vera give away. "Maybe he understands." They ate. Herb asked Sarah what Walt was doing in Washington, and she told him about the conference he was attending, which had to do with Indian land claims. The Republican meetings were mostly wind-testing exercises, she said. "Most of the people he's meeting with think that if Reagan is nominated over Ford next year, it's going to mean the death of the party," Sarah said. "And if the grand old party dies, that means Walt won't be able to run for Bill Cohen's seat in 1978 when Cohen goes after Bill Hathaway's Senate seat." Herb was watching Denny eat string beans, seriously, one by one, using all 6 of his teeth on them. "I don't think Cohen will be able to wait until 78 to get in the Senate. He'll run against Muskie next year." "Walt says Bill Cohen's not that big a dope," Sarah said. "He'll wait. Walt says his own chance is coming. I'm starting to believe him." After supper, they sat in the living room, and the talk turned away from politics. They watched Denny play with the old wooden cars and trucks that a much younger Herb Smith had made for his own son over a quarter of a century ago. A younger Herb Smith, who'd been married to a tough, good-humored woman who would sometimes drink a bottle of Black Label beer in the evening. A man with no gray in his hair and nothing but the highest hopes for his son. "He does understand," Johnny thought, sipping his coffee. "Whether he knows what went on between Sarah and me this afternoon, whether or not he suspects what might have gone on, he understands the basic cheat. You can't change it or rectify it. The best you can do is try to come to terms. This afternoon, she and I consummated a marriage that never was. And tonight, he's playing with his grandson." He thought of the Wheel of Fortune, Slowing, stopping, house number, everyone loses. Gloom was trying to creep up, a dismal sense of finality, and he pushed it away. This wasn't the time. He wouldn't let it be the time. By 8:30, Denny had begun to get scratchy and cross, and Sarah said, "Time for us to go, folks. He can suck a bottle on our way back to Kennebunk. About 3 miles from here, he'll have corked off. Thanks for hanging us." Her eyes, brilliant green, found Johnny's for a moment. "Our pleasure entirely," Herb said, standing up. "Right, Johnny?"
"Right," he said.
"Let me carry that carpet out for you, Sarah." At the door, Herb kissed the top of Denny's head, and Denny grabbed Herb's nose in his chubby fist and honked it hard enough to make Herb's eyes water, and Sarah's cheek. Johnny carried the car bed down to the red Pinto, and Sarah gave him the keys so he could put everything in the back. When he finished, she was standing by the driver's side door looking at him.
"It was the best we could do," she said, and smiled a little.
But the brilliance of her eyes told him the tears were close again. "It wasn't so bad at all," Johnny said.
"We'll stay in touch?"
"I don't know, Sarah. Will we?"
"No, I suppose not. It would be too easy, wouldn't it?"
"Pretty easy, yes." She stepped close and stretched to kiss his cheek. He could smell her hair, clean and fragrant.
"Take care," she whispered. "I'll think about you."
"Be good, Sarah," he said, and touched her nose. She turned then, got in behind the wheel, a smart young matron whose husband was on the way up. "I doubt like hell they'll be driving a Pinto next year," Johnny thought. The lights came on, then the little sewing machine motor roared. She raised a hand to him, and then she was pulling out of the driveway. Johnny stood by the chopping block, hands in his pockets, and watched her go. Something in his heart seemed to have closed. It was not a major feeling. That was the worst of it. It wasn't a major feeling at all. He watched until the taillights were out of sight, and then he climbed the porch steps and went back into the house. His dad was sitting in the big easy chair in the living room. The TV was off. The few toys he had found in the closet were scattered on the rug, and he was looking at them. "Good to see Sarah," Herb said. "Did you and she have..." There was the briefest, most minute hesitation. "A nice visit?" "Yes," Johnny said. "She'll be down again?" "No, I don't think so." He and his father were looking at each other. "Well, now, maybe that's for the best," Herb said. "Yes, maybe so." "You played with these toys," Herb said, getting down on his knees and beginning to gather them up. "I gave a bunch of them to Lottie Gaudreau when she had her twins, but I knew I had a few of them left. I saved a few back." He put them back in the box one by one, turning each of them over in his hands, examining them. A race car, a bulldozer, a police car, a small hook and ladder truck from which most of the red paint had been worn away, or a small hand with grip. He took them back to the entryway closet and put them away. Johnny didn't see Sarah Hazlitt again for 3 years. Chapter 16. 1. The snow came early that year. There were 6 inches on the ground by November 7th, and Johnny had taken to lacing on a pair of old green gum rubber boots and wearing his old parka for the trek up to the mailbox. 2 weeks before, Dave Pelson had mailed down a package containing the texts he would be using in January, and Johnny had already begun making tentative lesson plans. He was looking forward to getting back. Dave had also found him an apartment on Howland Street in Cleves, 24 Howland Street. Johnny kept that on a scrap of paper in his wallet, because the name and number had an irritating way of slipping his mind. On this day, the skies were slaty and lowering, the temperature hovering just below the 20-degree mark. As Johnny tramped up the driveway, the first spats of snow began to drift down. Because he was alone,
He didn't feel too self-conscious about running his tongue out and trying to catch a flake on it. He was hardly limping at all, and he felt good. There hadn't been a headache in 2 weeks or more. The mail consisted of an advertising circular, a Newsweek, and a small manila envelope addressed to John Smith, no return address. Johnny opened it on the way back, the rest of the mail stuffed into his hip pocket. He pulled out a single page of newsprint, saw the words "Inside View" at the top, and came to a halt halfway back to the house. It was page 3 of the previous week's issue. The headline story dealt with a reporter's exposé on the handsome second banana of a TV crime show. The second banana had been suspended from high school twice 12 years ago and busted for possession of cocaine 6 years ago. Hot news for the housefrows of America. There was also an all-grain diet, a cute baby photo, and the story of a 9-year-old girl who had been miraculously cured of cerebral palsy at Lourdes. "Doctors mystified," the headlines trumpeted gleefully. A story near the bottom of the page had been circled. "Maine psychic admits hoax," the headline read. The story was not bylined. It has always been the policy of Inside View not only to bring you the fullest coverage of the psychics which the so-called national press ignores, but to expose the tricksters and charlatans who have held back true acceptance of legitimate psychic phenomena for so long. One of these tricksters admitted his own hoax to an Inside View source recently. This so-called psychic, John Smith of Pownall, Maine, admitted to our source that "it was all a gimmick to pay back my hospital bills. If there's a book in it, I might come out with enough to pay off what I owe and retire for a couple of years in the bargain," Smith grinned. "These days, people will believe anything. Why shouldn't I get on the gravy train?" Thanks to Inside View, which has always cautioned readers that there are 2 phony psychics for each real one, John Smith's gravy train has just been derailed. And we reiterate our standing offer of $1,000 to anyone who can prove that any nationally known psychic is a fraud. Hoaxers and charlatans be warned. Johnny read the article twice as the snow began to come down more heavily. A reluctant grin broke over his features. The ever-vigilant press apparently didn't enjoy being thrown off some bumpkin's front porch, he thought. He tucked the tear sheet back into its envelope and stuffed it into his back pocket with the rest of the mail. "Deez," he said aloud, "I hope you're still black and blue." 2. His father was not so amused. Herb read the clipping and then slammed it down on the kitchen table in disgust. "You ought to sue that son of a whore. That's nothing but slander, Johnny. A deliberate hatchet job." "Agreed and agreed," Johnny said. It was dark outside. The afternoon's silently falling snow had developed into tonight's early winter blizzard. The wind shrieked and howled around the eaves. The driveway had disappeared under a dune-like progression of drifts. "But there was no third party when we talked, and Dee's damn well knows it. It's his word against mine." "He didn't even have the guts to put his own name to this lie," Herb said. "Look at this, an Inside View source. What's this source? Get him to name it, that's what I say." "Oh, you can't do that," Johnny said, grinning. "That's like walking up to the meanest street fighter on the block with a kick me hard sign taped to your crotch. Then they'll turn it into a holy war, page 1 and all. No thanks. As far as I'm concerned, they did me a favor. I don't want to make a career out of telling people where Gramps hid his stock certificates or who's going to win the 4th at Scarborough Downs or take this lottery." One of the things that had most surprised Johnny when coming out of his coma was to discover that Maine and about a dozen other states had instituted a legal numbers game. "In the last month, I've gotten 16 letters from people who want me to tell them what the number's going to be. It's insane. Even if I could tell them, which I couldn't, what good would it do them? You can't pick your own number in the Maine lottery. You get what they give you." "But still, I get the letters." I don't see what that has to do with this crappy article.
If people think I'm a phony, maybe they'll leave me alone.
Oh, Herb said. Yeah, I see what you mean. He lit his pipe. You've never really been comfortable with it, have you?
No, Johnny said. We never talk much about it either, which is something of a relief.
It seems like the only thing other people do want to talk about.
And it wasn't just that they wanted to talk. That wouldn't have bothered him so much. But when he was in Slocum's store for a six-pack or a loaf of bread, the girl would try to take his money without touching his hand, and the frightened, skittish look in her eyes was unmistakable. His father's friends would give him a little wave instead of a handshake. In October, Herb had hired a local high school girl to come in once a week to do some dusting and vacuum the floors. After 3 weeks, she had quit for no stated reason at all. Probably someone at her high school had told her who she was cleaning for. It seemed that for everyone who was anxious to be touched, to be informed, to be in contact with Johnny's peculiar talent, there was another who regarded him as a kind of leper. At times like these, Johnny would think of the nurses staring at him the day he had told Eileen McGowan that her house was on fire. Staring at him like magpies on a telephone wire. He would think of the way the TV reporter had drawn back from him after the press conference's unexpected conclusion, agreeing with everything he said, but not wanting to be touched. Unhealthy either way.
No, we don't talk about it, Herb agreed. It makes me think of your mother, I suppose. She was so sure you'd been given the whatever it is for some reason. Sometimes I wonder if she wasn't right.
Johnny shrugged. All I want is a normal life. I want to bury the whole damn thing. And if this little squib helps me do it, so much the better.
But you still can do it, can't you? Herb asked. He was looking closely at his son.
Johnny thought about a night not quite a week ago. They had gone out to dinner, a rare happening on their strapped budget. They had gone to Cole's Farm in Gray, probably the best restaurant in the area, a place that was always packed. The night had been cold, the dining room cheery and warm. Johnny had taken his father's coat and his own into the cloakroom, and he thumbed through the racked coats, looking for empty hangers. A whole series of clear impressions had cascaded through his mind. It was like that sometimes, and on another occasion, he could have handled every coat for 20 minutes and gotten nothing at all. Here was a lady's coat with a fur collar. She was having an affair with one of her husband's poker buddies, was scared sick about it, but didn't know how to close it off. A man's denim jacket, sheepskin lined. This guy was also worried about his brother, who'd been badly hurt on a construction project the week before. A small boy's parka. His grandmother in Durham had given him a Snoopy transistor radio just the day, and he was mad because his father hadn't let him bring it into the dining room with him. And another one, a plain black top coat that had turned him cold with terror and robbed him of his appetite. The man who owned this coat was going mad. So far he had kept up appearances. Not even his wife suspected. But his vision of the world was being slowly darkened by a series of increasingly paranoid fantasies. Touching that coat had been like touching a writhing coil of snakes.
Yes, I can still do it, Johnny said briefly. I wish to hell I couldn't.
You really mean that? Johnny thought of the plain black top coat. He'd only picked at his meal, looking this way and that, trying to single the man out of the crowd, unable to do so.
Yes, he said. I mean it.
Best forgotten, then, Herb said, and clapped his son on the shoulder.
3. And for the next month or so, it seemed that it would be forgotten. Johnny drove north to attend a meeting at the high school for mid-year teachers, and to take a load of his personal things up to his new apartment, which he found small but livable. He went in his father's car, and as he was getting ready to leave, Herb asked him,
"You're not nervous about driving?"
Johnny shook his head. Thoughts of the accident itself troubled him very little now. If something was going to happen to him, it would. And deep down he felt confident that lightning would not strike in the same place again.
When he died, he didn't believe it would be in a car accident. In fact, the long trip was quiet and soothing. The meeting a little bit like old home week. All of his old colleagues who were still teaching at CMHS dropped by to wish him the best. But he couldn't help noticing how few of them actually shook hands with him. And he seemed to sense a certain reserve, a wariness in their eyes. Driving home, he convinced himself it was probably imagination. And if not, well, even that had its amusing side. If they had read their inside view, they would know he was a hoax and nothing to worry about. The meeting was over. There was nothing to do but go back to Pownall and wait for the Christmas holiday to come and go. The packages containing personal objects stopped coming, almost as if a switch had been thrown. The power of the press, Johnny told his father. They were replaced by a spate of angry and mostly anonymous letters and cards from people who seemed to feel personally cheated. You ought to burn in H-E-L-L for your slimy schemes to bilk this American Republic, a typical one read. It had been written on a crumpled sheet of Ramada Inn stationery and was postmarked York, Pennsylvania. You are nothing but a con artist and a dirty, rotten cheat. I bless God for that paper that saw through you. You ought to be ashamed of yourself, sir. The Bible says an ordinary sinner will be cast into the lake of F-I-R-E and be consumed. But a F-A-U-L-S-E-P-R-O-F-I-T shall burn forever and ever. That's you, a false prophet, who sold your immortal soul for a few cheap bucks. So that's the end of my letter, and I hope for your sake I never catch you out on the streets of your hometown. Signed, a friend of God, not you, sir. Over 2 dozen letters in this approximate vein came in during the course of about 20 days following the appearance of the Inside View story. Several enterprising souls expressed an interest in joining in with Johnny as partners. I used to be a magician's assistant, one of these latter missives bragged, and I could trick an old whore out of her G-string. If you're planning a mentalist gig, you need me in. Then the letters dried up, as had the earlier influx of boxes and packages. On a day in late November, when he had checked the mailbox and found it empty for the 3rd afternoon in a row, Johnny walked back to the house, remembering that Andy Warhol had predicted that a day would come when everyone in America would be famous for 15 minutes. Apparently, his 15 minutes had come and gone, and no one was any more pleased about it than he was. But as things turned out, it wasn't over yet. 4.
Smith? The telephone voice asked. John Smith? Yes. It wasn't a voice he knew or a wrong number. That made it something of a puzzle since his father had had the phone unlisted about 3 months ago. This was December 17th, and their tree stood in the corner of the living room, its base firmly wedged into the old tree stand Herb had made when Johnny was just a kid. Outside it was snowing.
My name is Bannerman, Sheriff George Bannerman from Castle Rock.
He cleared his throat.
I've got a, well, I suppose you'd say I've got a proposal for you.
How did you get this number?
Bannerman cleared his throat again. Well, I could have gotten it from the phone company, I suppose, it being police business, but actually I got it from a friend of yours, doctor by the name of Wyzak.
Sam Wyzak gave you my number?
That's right.
Johnny sat down in the phone nook, utterly perplexed. Now the name Bannerman meant something to him. He had come across the name in a Sunday supplement article only recently. He was the sheriff of Castle County, which was considerably west of Pownall, in the Lakes region. Castle Rock was the county seat, about 30 miles from Norway and 20 from Bridgeton.
Police business, he repeated.
Well, I guess you'd say so, eh? I was wondering if maybe the two of us could get together for a cup of coffee.
It involves Sam?
No, Dr. Wyzak has nothing to do with it. Bannerman said. He gave me a call and mentioned your name. That was, a month ago at least. To be frank, I thought he was nuts, but now we're just about at our wits' end.
About what, Mr. Sheriff Bannerman? I don't understand what you're talking about.
It'd really be a lot better if we could get together for coffee, Bannerman said. Maybe this evening. There's a place called John's on the main drag in Bridgeton, sort of halfway between your town and mine.
No, I'm sorry, Johnny said. I'd have to know what it was about. And how come Sam never called me?
Bannerman sighed. I guess you're a man who doesn't read the papers, he said.
But that wasn't true. He had read the papers compulsively since he had regained consciousness, trying to pick up on the things he had missed. And he had seen Bannerman's name just recently, sure, because Bannerman was on a pretty hot seat. He was the man in charge of... Johnny held the phone away from his ear and looked at it with sudden understanding. He looked at it the way a man might look at a snake he has just realized is poisonous.
Mr. Smith, it squawked tinnily. Hello, Mr. Smith.
I'm here, Johnny said, putting the phone back to his ear. He was conscious of a dull anger at Sam Wysack. Sam, who had told him to keep his head down only this summer, and then had turned around and given this local yokel sheriff an earful, behind Johnny's back.
It's that strangling business, isn't it?
Bannerman hesitated a long time. Then he said,
Could we talk, Mr. Smith?
No, absolutely not. The dull anger had ignited into sudden fury. Fury and something else. He was scared.
Mr. Smith, it's important. Today,
no! I want to be left alone. Besides, don't you read the goddamn inside view? I'm a fake anyway!
Dr. Wysack said.
He had no business saying anything, Johnny shouted. He was shaking all over. Goodbye!
He slammed the phone into its cradle and got out of the phone nook quickly, as if that would prevent it from ringing again. He could feel a headache beginning in his temples. Dull drill bits.
Maybe I should call his mother out there in California, he thought. Tell her where her little sunny buns is. Tell her to get in touch. Tit for tat.
Instead, he hunted in the address book in the phone table drawer, found Sam's office number in Bangor, and called it. As soon as it rang once on the other end, he hung up, scared again.
Why had Sam done that to him? God damn it, why?
He found himself looking at the Christmas tree. Same old decorations. They had dragged them down from the attic again and taken them out of their tissue paper cradles again and hung them up again just 2 evenings ago. It was a funny thing about Christmas decorations. There weren't many things that remained intact year after year as a person grew up. Not many lines of continuity. Not many physical objects that could easily serve both the states of childhood and adulthood. Your kid clothes were handed down or packed off to the Salvation Army. Your Donald Duck watch sprung its mainspring. Your Red Ryder cowboy boots wore out. The wallet you made in your first camp handicrafts class got replaced by a Lord Buxton, and you traded your red wagon and your bike for more adult toys, a car, a tennis racket, maybe one of those new TV hockey games. There were only a few things you could hang on to, a few books maybe, or a lucky coin, or a stamp collection that had been preserved and improved upon. Add to that the Christmas tree ornaments in your parents' house. The same chipped angels year after year, and the same tinsel star on top. The tough surviving platoon of what had once been an entire battalion of glass balls. And we never forget the honored dead, he thought. This one died as a result of a baby's clutching hand. This one slipped as Dad was putting it on and crashed to the floor. The red one with the Star of Bethlehem painted on it was simply and mysteriously broken one year when we took them down from the attic, and I cried. The tree stand itself. But sometimes, Johnny thought, absently massaging his temples, it seemed it would be better, more merciful, if you lost touch with even these last vestiges of childhood.
You could never discover the books that had first turned you on in quite the same way. The lucky coin had not protected you from any of the ordinary whips and scorns and scrapes of an ordinary life. And when you looked at the ornaments, you remembered that there had once been a mother in the place to direct the tree-trimming operation, always ready and willing to piss you off by saying, "A little higher," or "A little lower," or "I think you've got too much tinsel on that left side, dear." You looked at the ornaments and remembered that just the two of you had been around to put them up this year. Just the two of you, because your mother went crazy and then she died. But the fragile Christmas tree ornaments were still there, still hanging around to decorate another tree taken from the small backwood lot. And didn't they say more people committed suicide around Christmas than at any other time of the year? By God, it was no wonder.
What a power God has given you, Johnny.
Sure, that's right. God's a real prince. He knocked me through the windshield of a cab, and I broke my legs and spent 5 years or so in a coma, and three people died. The girl I loved got married. She had the son who should have been mine, by a lawyer who's breaking his ass to get to Washington so he can help run the big electric train set. If I'm on my feet for more than a couple hours at a time, it feels like somebody took a long splinter and rammed it straight up my leg to my balls. God's a real sport. He's such a sport that he fixed up a funny comic opera world where a bunch of glass Christmas tree globes could outlive you. Neat world, and a really first-class God in charge of it. He must have been on our side during Vietnam, because that's the way he's been running things ever since time began.
He has a job for you, Johnny.
Bailing some half-ass county cop out of a jam so he can get re-elected next year?
Don't run from him, Johnny. Don't hide away in a cave.
He rubbed his temples. Outside, the wind was rising. He hoped Dad would be careful coming home from work. Johnny got up and pulled on a heavy sweatshirt. He went out into the shed, watching his breath frost the air ahead of him. To the left was a large pile of wood he had split in the autumn just past, all of it cut into neat stove lengths. Next to it was a box of kindling, and beside that was a stack of old newspapers. He squatted down and began to thumb through them. His hands went numb quickly, but he kept going, and eventually he came to the one he was looking for, the Sunday paper from 3 weeks ago. He took it into the house, slapped it down on the kitchen table, and began to root through it. He found the article he was looking for in the features section and sat down to reread it. The article was accompanied by several photos, one of them showing an old woman locking a door, another showing a police car cruising a nearly deserted street, two others showing a couple of businesses that were nearly deserted. The headline read, "The Hunt for the Castle Rock Strangler Goes On and On." 5 years ago, according to the story, a young woman named Alma Frechette, who worked at a local restaurant, had been raped and strangled on her way home from work. A joint investigation of the crime had been conducted by the State Attorney General's office and the Castle County Sheriff's Department. The result had been a total zero. A year later, an elderly woman, also raped and strangled, had been discovered in her tiny third-floor apartment on Carbine Street in Castle Rock. A month later, the killer had struck again. This time, the victim had been a bright young junior high school girl. There had been a more intensive investigation. The investigative facilities of the FBI had been utilized, all to no result. The following November, Sheriff Carl M. Kelso, who had been the county's chief law officer since approximately the days of the Civil War, had been voted out, and George Bannerman had been voted in, largely on an aggressive campaign to catch the Castle Rock Strangler. 2 years passed. The strangler had not been apprehended, but no further murders occurred either. Then, last January, the body of 17-year-old Carol Dunbarger had been found by two small boys. The Dunbarger girl had been reported as a missing person by her parents. She had been in and out of trouble at Castle Rock High School, where she had a record of chronic tardiness and truancy.
She had been busted twice for shoplifting, and had run away once before, getting as far as Boston. Both Bannerman and the state police assumed she had been thumbing a ride, and the killer had picked her up. A midwinter thaw had uncovered her body near Strimmer's Brook, where two small boys had found it. The state medical examiner said she had been dead about 2 months. Then, this November 2nd, there had been yet another murder. The victim was a well-liked Castle Rock Grammar School teacher named Etta Ringgold. She was a lifetime member of the local Methodist church, holder of an MBS in elementary education, and prominent in local charities. She had been fond of the works of Robert Browning, and her body had been found stuffed into a culvert that ran beneath an unpaved secondary road. The uproar of the murder of Miss Ringgold had rumbled over all of northern New England. Comparisons to Albert DeSalvo, the Boston Strangler, were made. Comparisons that did nothing to pour oil on the troubled waters. William Loeb's union leader in not-so-distant Manchester, New Hampshire, had published a helpful editorial titled, "The Do-Nothing Cops in Our Sister State." The Sunday Supplement article, now nearly 4 weeks old and smelling pungently of shed and woodbox, quoted two local psychiatrists who had been perfectly happy to blue-sky the situation as long as their names weren't printed. One of them mentioned a particular sexual aberration, the urge to commit some violent act at the moment of orgasm. Nice, Johnny thought, grimacing. He strangled them to death as he came. His headache was getting worse all the time. The other shrink pointed out the fact that all five murders had been committed in late fall or early winter, and while the manic depressive personality didn't conform to any one set pattern, it was fairly common for such a person to have mood swings closely paralleling the change of the seasons. He might have a low lasting from mid-April until about the end of August, and then begin to climb, peaking at around the time of the murders. During the manic or upstate, the person in question was apt to be highly sexed, active, daring, and optimistic. He would be likely to believe the police unable to catch him, the unnamed psychiatrist had finished. The article concluded by saying that, so far, the person in question had been right. Johnny put the paper down, glanced at the clock, and saw his father should be home almost any time, unless the snow was holding him up. He took the old newspaper over to the wood stove and poked it into the firebox. Not my business. Goddamn Sam Wysack, anyway. Don't hide away in a cave, Johnny. He wasn't hiding away in a cave. That wasn't it at all. It just so happened that he'd had a fairly tough break. Losing a big chunk of your life? That qualified you for tough break status, didn't it? And all the self-pity you can guzzle? Fuck you, he muttered to himself. He went to the window and looked out. Nothing to see but snow falling in heavy, wind-driven lines. He hoped Dad was being careful, but he also hoped his father would show up soon and put an end to this useless rat run of introspection. He went over to the telephone again and stood there, undecided. Self-pity or not, he had lost a goodish chunk of his life. His prime, if you wanted to put it that way. He had worked hard to get it back. Didn't he deserve some ordinary privacy? Didn't he have a right to what he had just been thinking of a few minutes ago? An ordinary life? There is no such thing, my man. Maybe not, but there sure was such a thing as an abnormal life. That thing at Cole's farm, feeling people's clothes and suddenly knowing their little dreads, small secrets, petty triumphs. That was abnormal. It was a talent. It was a curse. Suppose he did meet this sheriff. There was no guarantee he could tell him a thing. And suppose he could. Just suppose he could hand him his killer on a silver platter. It would be the hospital press conference all over again. A three-ring circus raised to the grisly nth power. A little song began to run maddeningly through his aching head. Little more than a jingle, really. A Sunday school song from his early childhood.
This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. Let it shine, shine, shine. Let it shine.
He picked up the phone and dialed Wyzak's office number. Safe enough now after 5. Wyzak would have gone home, and big deal neurologists don't list their home phones. The phone rang 6 or 7 times, and Johnny was going to put it down when it was answered, and Sam himself said, "Hi, hello? Sam?
John Smith?"
The pleasure in Sam's voice was unmistakable. But was there also an undercurrent of unease in it? "Yeah, it's me." "How do you like the snow?" Wyzak said, maybe a little too heartily. "Is it snowing where you are?" "It's snowing. Just started here about an hour ago. They say, John, is it the sheriff? Is that why you sound so cold?"
"Well, he called me," Johnny said, "and I've been sort of wondering what happened. Why you gave him my name. Why you didn't call me and say you had. And why you didn't call me first and ask if you could."
Wyzak sighed. "Johnny, I could maybe give you a lie, but that would be no good. I didn't ask you first because I was afraid you would say no. And I didn't tell you I'd done it afterward because the sheriff laughed at me. When someone laughs at one of my suggestions, I assume, nah, that the suggestion is not going to be taken."
Johnny rubbed at one aching temple with his free hand and closed his eyes. "But why, Sam? You know how I feel about that. You were the one who told me to keep my head down and let it blow over. You told me that yourself."
"It was the piece in the paper," Sam said. "I said to myself, Johnny lives down that way. And I said to myself, 5 dead women. 5.
His voice was slow, halting, and embarrassed. It made Johnny feel much worse to hear Sam sounding like this. He wished he hadn't called.
"2 of them teenage girls, a young mother, a teacher of young children who love Browning. All of it so corny, no? So corny I suppose they would never make a movie or a TV show out of it. But nonetheless, true. It was the teacher I thought about most. Stuffed into a culvert like a bag of garbage."
"You had no damn right to bring me into your guilt fantasies," Johnny said thickly.
"No, perhaps not."
"No perhaps about it."
"Johnny, are you all right? You sound..."
"I'm fine," Johnny shouted.
"You don't sound fine."
"I've got a shitter of a headache. Is that so surprising? I wish to Christ you'd left us alone. When I told you about your mother, you didn't call her. Because you said..."
"I said some things are better lost than found. But that is not always true, Johnny. This man, whoever he is, has a terribly disturbed personality. He may kill himself. I am sure that when he stopped for 2 years, the police thought he had. But a manic depressive sometimes has long level periods. It's called a plateau of normality, and then goes back to the same mood swings. He may have killed himself after murdering that teacher last month. But if he hasn't, what then? He may kill another one. Or 2, or 4, or..."
"Stop it!"
"Why did Sheriff Bannerman call you? What made him change his mind?"
"I don't know. I suppose the voters are after him."
"I'm sorry I called him, Johnny, and that this has upset you so. But even more, I am sorry that I did not call you and tell you what I had done. I was wrong. God knows you have a right to live your life quietly."
Hearing his own thoughts echoed did not make him feel better. Instead, he felt more miserable and guilty than ever.
"All right," he said. "That's okay, Sam."
"I'll not say anything to anyone again. I suppose that is like putting a new lock on the barn door after a horse theft. But it's all I can say. I was indiscreet. In a doctor, that's bad."
"All right," Johnny said again. He felt helpless, and the slow embarrassment with which Sam spoke made it worse.
"I'll see you soon." "I'll be up in Cleves next month to start teaching. I'll drop by."
"Good.
Again, my sincerest apologies, John."
"Stop saying that."
They said their goodbyes, and Johnny hung up, wishing he hadn't called at all, Maybe he hadn't wanted Sam to agree so readily that what he had done was wrong. Maybe what he had really wanted Sam to say was,
"Sure, I called him. I wanted you to get off your ass and do something."
He wandered across to the window and looked out into the blowing darkness. Stuffed into a culvert like a bag of garbage. God, how his head ached.
5. Herb got home half an hour later, took one look at Johnny's white face and said,
"Headache?"
"Yeah."
"Bad?"
"Not too bad."
"We want to watch the national news," Herb said. "Glad I got home in time. Bunch of people from NBC were over in Castle Rock this afternoon filming. That lady reporter you think is so pretty was there, Cassie Mackin."
He blinked at the way Johnny turned on him. For a moment it seemed that Johnny's face was all eyes, staring out at him and full of nearly inhuman pain.
Castle Rock. Another murder?
"Yeah, they found a little girl on the town common this morning. Saddest damn thing you ever heard of. I guess she had a pass to go across the common to the library for some project she was working on. She got to the library, but she never got back. Johnny, looked terrible, boy."
"How old was she?"
"Just 9, Herb said. "A man who'd do a thing like that should be strung up by the balls. That's my view on it."
9, Johnny said, and sat down heavily. "Stone the crows."
"Johnny, you sure you feel okay? You're white as paper."
"Fine. Turn on the news."
Shortly, John Chancellor was in front of them, bearing his nightly satchel of political aspirations. Fred Harris's campaign was not catching much fire. Government edicts. The cities of America would just have to learn common budgetary sense, according to President Ford. International incidents. A nationwide strike in France. The Dow Jones, up, and a heartwarming piece about a boy with cerebral palsy who was raising a 4-H cow.
"Maybe they cut it," Herb said.
But after a commercial, Chancellor said,
"In western Maine, there's a town full of frightened, angry people tonight. The town is Castle Rock, and over the last 5 years, there have been 5 nasty murders. 5 women ranging in age from 71 to 14. Have been raped and strangled. Today, there was a 6th murder in Castle Rock, and the victim was a 9-year-old girl. Catherine Mackin is in Castle Rock with the story."
And there she was, looking like a figment of make-believe carefully superimposed on a real setting. She was standing across from the town office building. The first of the afternoon's snow, which had developed into tonight's blizzard, was powdering the shoulders of her coat and her blonde hair.
"A sense of quietly mounting hysteria lies over this small New England mill town this afternoon," she began. "The townspeople of Castle Rock have been nervous for a long time over the unknown person the local press calls the Castle Rock Strangler, or sometimes the November Killer. That nervousness has changed to terror. No one here thinks that word is too strong. Following the discovery of Mary Kate Henderson's body on the town common, not far from the bandstand where the body of the November Killer's first victim, a waitress named Alma Frechette, was discovered." A long panning shot of the town common, looking bleak and dead in the falling snow. This was replaced by a school photograph of Mary Kate Henderson, grinning brashly, through a heavy set of braces. Her hair was a fine white blonde. Her dress was an electric blue. Most likely her best dress, Johnny thought sickly. Her mother put her into her best dress for her school photo. The reporter went on. Now they were recapitulating the past murders. But Johnny was on the phone. First to directory assistants, and then to the Castle Rock town offices. He dialed slowly, his head thudding. Herb came out of the living room and looked at him curiously. "Who are you calling, son?" Johnny shook his head and listened to the phone ring on the other end. It was picked up. "Castle County Sheriff's Office."
"I'd like to talk to Sheriff Bannerman, please."
"Could I have your name?"
John Smith from Pownell. Hold on, please. Johnny turned to look at the TV and saw Bannerman, as he had been that afternoon, bundled up in a heavy parka with county sheriff patches on the shoulders. He looked uncomfortable and dogged as he fielded the reporter's questions. He was a broad-shouldered man with a big, sloping head capped with curly dark hair. The rimless glasses he wore looked strangely out of place, as spectacles always seemed to look out of place on very big men. "We're following up a number of leads," Bannerman said. "Hello, Mr. Smith," Bannerman said. Again, that queer sense of doubling. Bannerman was in two places at one time, two times at one time, if you wanted to look at it that way. Johnny felt an instant of helpless vertigo. He felt the way, God help him, you felt on one of those cheap carnival rides, the tilt-a-whirl or the crack-the-whip.
"Mr. Smith, are you there, man?"
"Yes, I'm here," he swallowed. "I've changed my mind."
"Good boy. I'm damn glad to hear it.
I still may not be able to help you, you know."
"I know that, but no venture, no gain." Bannerman cleared his throat. "They'd run me out of this town on a rail if they knew I was down to consulting a psychic."
Johnny's face was touched with the ghost of a grin. And a discredited psychic at that.
"Do you know where John's in Bridgeton is?"
"I can find it."
"Can you meet me there at 8 o'clock?
"Yes, I think so."
"Thank you, Mr. Smith."
"All right." He hung up. Herb was watching him closely. Behind him, the nightly news credits were rolling.
"He called you earlier, huh?"
"Yeah, he did. Sam Wysak told him I might be able to help."
"Do you think you can?"
"I don't know," Johnny said. "But my headache feels a little better."
6. He was 15 minutes late getting into John's restaurant in Bridgeton. It seemed to be the only business establishment on Bridgeton's main drag that was still open. The plows were falling behind the snow, and there were drifts across the road in several places. At the junction of routes 302 and 117, the blinker light swayed back and forth in the screaming wind. A police cruiser with Castle County Sheriff in gold leaf on the door was parked in front of John's. He parked behind it and went inside. Bannerman was sitting at a table in front of a cup of coffee and a bowl of chili. The TV had misled. He wasn't a big man. He was a huge man. Johnny walked over and introduced himself. Bannerman stood up and shook the offered hand. Looking at Johnny's white, strained face and the way his thin body seemed to float inside his navy pea jacket, Bannerman's first thought was, "This guy's sick. He's maybe not going to live too long." Only Johnny's eyes seemed to have any real life. They were a direct, piercing blue, and they fixed firmly on Bannerman's own with sharp, honest curiosity. And when their hands clasped, Bannerman felt a peculiar kind of surprise, a sensation he would later describe as a draining. It was a little like getting a shock from a bare electrical wire. Then it was gone.
"Glad you could come," Bannerman said. "Coffee?"
"Yes."
"How about a bowl of chili? They make great damn chili here. I'm not supposed to eat it because of my ulcer, but I do anyway."
He saw the look of surprise on Johnny's face and smiled. "I know, doesn't seem right. Great big guy like me having an ulcer, does it?"
"I guess anyone can get one."
"You're damn tootin'," Bannerman said.
"What changed your mind?"
"It was the news, the little girl. Are you sure it was the same guy?"
"It was the same guy, same M.O., and the same sperm type."
He watched Johnny's face as the waitress came over.
"Coffee?"
she asked.
"Tea," Johnny said.
"And bring him a bowl of chili, miss," Bannerman said. When the waitress had gone, he said, "This doctor, he says that if you touch something, sometimes you get ideas about where it came from, who might have owned it, that sort of thing." Johnny smiled. "Well," he said,
I just shook your hand, and I know you've got an Irish setter named Rusty, and I know he's old and going blind, and you think it's time he was put to sleep, but you don't know how to explain it to your girl. Bannerman dropped his spoon back into his chili. Plop. He stared at Johnny with his mouth open. By God, he said. You got that from me? Just now? Johnny nodded. Bannerman shook his head and muttered, It's one thing to hear something like that, and another to... Doesn't it tire you out? Johnny looked at Bannerman surprised. It was a question he had never been asked before. Yes. Yes, it does. But you knew, I'll be damned. But look, Sheriff. George. Just plain George. Okay, I'm Johnny. Just Johnny. George. What I don't know about you would fill about 5 books. I don't know where you grew up, or where you went to police school, or who your friends are, or where you live. I know you've got a little girl, and her name's something like Kathy, but that's not quite it. I don't know what you did last week, or what beer you favor, or what your favorite TV program is. My daughter's name is Katrina, Bannerman said softly. She's 9'2". She was in Mary Kate's class. What I'm trying to say is that the knowing is sometimes a pretty limited thing because of the dead zone. Dead zone? It's like some of the signals don't conduct, Johnny said. I can never get streets or addresses. Numbers are hard, but they sometimes come. The waitress returned with Johnny's tea and chili. He tasted the chili and nodded at Bannerman. You're right, it's good, especially on a night like this. Go to it, Bannerman said. Man, I love good chili. My ulcer hollers bloody hell about it. Fuck you, ulcer, I say. Down the hatch. They were quiet for a moment. Johnny worked on his chili and Bannerman watched him curiously. He supposed Smith could have found out he had a dog named Rusty. He even could have found out that Rusty was old and nearly blind. Take it a step farther. If he knew Katrina's name, he might have done that something like Kathy, but that's not quite it routine. Just to add the right touch of hesitant realism. But why? And none of that explained that queer, zapped feeling he'd gotten in his head when Smith touched his hand. If it was a con, it was a damn good one. Outside, the wind gusted to a low shriek that seemed to rock the small building on its foundations. A flying veil of snow lashed the Pondicherry bowling lanes across the street. Listen to that, Bannerman said. Supposed to keep up all night. Don't tell me the winters are getting milder. Have you got something? Johnny asked. Something that belonged to the guy you're looking for? We think we might, Bannerman said, and then shook his head. But it's pretty thin. Tell me. Bannerman laid it out for him. The grammar school and the library sat facing each other across the town common. It was standard operating procedure to send students across when they needed a book for a project or a report. The teacher gave them a pass, and the librarian initialed it before sending them back. Near the center of the common, the land dipped slightly. On the west side of the dip was the town bandstand. In the dip itself were 2 dozen benches where people sat during band concerts and football rallies in the fall. We think he just sat himself down and waited for a kid to come along. He would have been out of sight from both sides of the common, but the footpath runs along the north side of the dip, close to those benches. Bannerman shook his head slowly. What makes it worse is that the Frechette woman was killed right on the bandstand. I'm gonna face a shitstorm about that at town meeting in March. That is, if I'm still around in March. Well, I can show them a memo I wrote to the town manager requesting adult crossing guards on the common during school hours. Not that it was this killer that I was worried about. Christ, no. Never in my wildest dreams did I think he'd go back to the same spot a second time. The town manager turned down the crossing guards? Not enough money, Bannerman said. Of course, you can spread the blame around to the town selectmen, and they'll try to spread it back on me, and the grass will grow up on Mary Kate Henderson's grave, and... He paused a moment, or perhaps choked on what he was saying. Johnny gazed at his lowered head sympathetically. It might not have made any difference anyhow, Bannerman went on in a drier voice. Most of the crossing guards we use are women. and this fuck we're after doesn't seem to care how old or young they are.
But you think he waited on one of those benches?
Bannerman did. They'd found an even dozen fresh cigarette butts near the end of one of the benches, and four more behind the bandstand itself, along with an empty box. Marlboro's, unfortunately. The second or third most popular brand in the country. The cellophane on the box had been dusted for prints, and had yielded none at all.
None at all? Johnny said. That's a little funny, isn't it?
Why do you say so?
Well, you'd guess the killer was wearing gloves even if he wasn't thinking about prints. It was cold out. But you'd think the guy that sold him the cigarettes...
Bannerman grinned. You got a head for this work, he said. But you're not a smoker.
No, Johnny said. I used to smoke a few cigarettes when I was in college, but I lost the habit after my accident.
A man keeps his cigarettes in his breast pocket. Take them out, get a cigarette, put the pack back. If you're wearing gloves and not leaving fresh prints every time you get a butt, what you're doing is polishing that cellophane wrapper. Get it? And you missed one other thing, Johnny. Need me to tell you?
Johnny thought it over and then said, maybe the pack of cigarettes came out of a carton. And those cartons are packed by machine.
That's it, Bannerman said. You are good at this.
What about the tax stamp on the package?
Maine, Bannerman said.
So, if the killer and the smoker were the same man, Johnny said thoughtfully.
Bannerman shrugged. Sure, there's the technical possibility that they weren't. But I've tried to imagine who else would want to sit on a bench in the town common on a cold, cloudy winter morning long enough to smoke 12 or 16 cigarettes, and I come up blank.
Johnny sipped his tea. None of the other kids that cross saw anything?
Nothing, Bannerman said. I've talked to every kid that had a library pass this morning.
That's a lot weirder than the fingerprint business. Doesn't it strike you that way?
It strikes me as goddamn scary. Look, the guy is sitting there, and what he's waiting for is one kid, one girl, by herself. He can hear the kids as they come along, and each time he fades back behind the bandstand.
Tracks, Johnny said.
Not this morning. There was no snow cover this morning, just frozen ground. So here's this crazy shitbag that ought to have his own testicles carved off and served to him for dinner. Here he is, skulking behind the bandstand. At about 8:50 a.m., Peter Harrington and Melissa Loggins came along. School has been in session about 20 minutes at that time. When they're gone, he goes back to his bench. At 9:15, he fades back behind the bandstand again. This time it's two little girls, Susan Flaherty and Katrina Bannerman.
Johnny set his mug of tea down with a bang. Bannerman had taken off his spectacles and was polishing them savagely.
Your daughter crossed this morning? Jesus.
Bannerman put his glasses on again. His face was dark and dull with fury. And he's afraid, Johnny saw. Not afraid that the voters would turn him out, or that the union leader would publish another editorial about nitwit cops in western Maine, but afraid because if his daughter had happened to go to the library alone this morning...
My daughter, Bannerman agreed softly. I think she passed within 40 feet of that animal. You know what that makes me feel like?
I can guess, Johnny said.
No, I don't think you can. It makes me feel like I almost stepped into an empty elevator shaft. Like I passed up the mushrooms at dinner, and someone else died of toadstool poisoning. And it makes me feel dirty. It makes me feel filthy. I guess maybe it also explains why I finally called you. I'd do anything right now to nail this guy. Anything at all. Outside, a giant orange plow loomed out of the snow like something from a horror movie. It parked, and two men got out. They crossed the street to John's and sat at the counter. Johnny finished his tea. He no longer wanted the chili.
This guy goes back to his bench, Bannerman resumed, but not for long. Around 9:25, he hears the Harrington boy and the Loggins girl come back from the library. So he goes back behind the bandstand again.
It must have been around 9:25 because the librarian signed them out at 9:18. At 9:45, three boys from the fifth grade went past the bandstand on their way to the library. One of them thinks he might have seen some guy standing on the other side of the bandstand. That's our whole description, some guy. We ought to put it out on the wire. What do you think? Be on the lookout for some guy. Bannerman uttered a short laugh like a bark. At 9:55, my daughter and her friend Susan go by on their way back to school. Then, about 10:05, Mary Kate Henderson came along, by herself. Katrina and Sue met her going down the school steps as they were going up. They all said hi.
Dear God, Johnny muttered.
He ran his hands through his hair. Last of all, 10:30 a.m., the three fifth-grade boys are coming back. One of them sees something on the bandstand. It's Mary Kate, with a leotard and her underpants yanked down. Blood all over her legs, her face. Her face. Take it easy, Johnny said, and put a hand on Bannerman's arm. No, I can't take it easy, Bannerman said. He spoke almost apologetically. I've never seen anything like that. Not in 18 years of police work. He raped that little girl, and that would have been enough to, you know, kill her. The medical examiner said the way he did it, he ruptured something and it probably would have, well, killed her. But then he had to go on and choke her. 9 years old, and choked and left. Left on the bandstand with her underpants pulled down. Suddenly, Bannerman began to cry. The tears filled his eyes behind his glasses, and then rolled down his face in two streams. At the counter, the two guys from the Bridgeton Road crew were talking about the Super Bowl. Bannerman took his glasses off again and mopped his face with his handkerchief. His shoulders shook and heaved. Johnny waited, stirring his chili aimlessly. After a little while, Bannerman put his handkerchief away. His eyes were red, and Johnny thought how oddly naked his face looked without his glasses. I'm sorry, man, he said. It's been a very long day. It's all right, Johnny said. I knew I was going to do that, but I thought I could hold on until I got home to my wife. Well, I guess that was just too long to wait. You're a sympathetic ear, Bannerman slipped his glasses back on. No, you're more than that. You've got something. I'll be damned if I know just what it is, but it's something. What else have you got to go on? Nothing. I'm taking most of the heat, but the state police haven't exactly distinguished themselves. Neither has the Attorney General's special investigator or our pet FBI man. The county ME has been able to type the sperm, but that's no good to us at this stage of the game. The thing that bothers me the most is the lack of hair or skin under the victim's fingernails. They all must have struggled, but we don't have as much as a centimeter of skin. The devil must be on this guy's side. He hasn't dropped a button or a shopping list or left a single damn track. We got a shrink from Augusta, also courtesy of the state AG, and he tells us all these guys give themselves away sooner or later. Some comfort. What if it's later? Say about 12 bodies from now. The cigarette pack is in Castle Rock? Yes. Johnny stood up. Well, let's take a ride. My car? Johnny smiled a little as the wind rose, shrieking outside. On a night like this, it pays to be with a policeman, he said. 7. The snowstorm was at its height, and it took them an hour and a half to get over to Castle Rock in Bannerman's cruiser. It was 10:20 when they came in through the foyer in the town office building and stamped the snow off their boots. There were half a dozen reporters in the lobby, most of them sitting on a bench under the gruesome oil portrait of some town founding father, telling each other about previous night watches. They were up and surrounding Bannerman and Johnny in no time. Sheriff Bannerman, is it true there has been a break in the case? I have nothing for you at this time, Bannerman said stolidly.
There's been a rumor that you've taken a man from Oxford into custody, Sheriff. Is that true? No. If you folks will pardon us. But their attention had turned to Johnny, and he felt a sinking sensation in his belly as he recognized at least two faces from the press conference at the hospital. Holy God, one of them exclaimed. You're John Smith, aren't you? Johnny felt a crazy urge to take the fifth like a gangster at a Senate committee hearing. Yes, he said, that's me. The psychic guy? Another asked. Look, let us pass, Bannerman said, raising his voice. Haven't you guys got anything better to do than... According to Inside View, you're a fake, a young man in a heavy top coat said. Is that true? All I can say about that is Inside View prints what they want, Johnny said. Look, really, you're denying the Inside View story? Look, I really can't say anything more. As they went through the frosted glass door and into the sheriff's office, the reporters were racing toward the two payphones on the wall by the dog warden's office. Now the shit has truly hit the fan, Bannerman said unhappily. I swear before God, I never thought they'd still be here on a night like this. I should have brought you in the back. Oh, didn't you know? Johnny asked bitterly. We love the publicity. All of us psychics are in it for the publicity. No, I don't believe that, Bannerman said. At least not of you. Well, it's happened. Can't be helped now. But in his mind, Johnny could visualize the headlines. A little extra seasoning in a pot of stew that was already bubbling briskly. Castle Rock Sheriff deputizes local psychic in Strangler case. November killer to be investigated by Seer. Hoax admission. Story of fabrication. Smith protests. There were two deputies in the outer office, one of them snoozing, the other drinking coffee and looking glumly through a pile of reports. His wife kick him out or something? Bannerman asked sourly, nodding toward the sleeper. He just got back from Augusta, the deputy said. He was little more than a kid himself, and there were dark circles of weariness under his eyes. He glanced over at Johnny curiously. Johnny Smith, Frank Dodd. Sleeping Beauty over there is Roscoe Fisher. Johnny nodded hello. Roscoe says the AG wants the whole case, Dodd told Bannerman. His look was angry and defiant and somehow pathetic. Some Christmas present, huh? Bannerman put a hand on the back of Dodd's neck and shook him gently. You worry too much, Frank. Also, you're spending too much time on the case. I just keep thinking there must be something in these reports. He shrugged and flicked them with one finger. Something. Go home and get some rest, Frank. And take Sleeping Beauty with you. All we need is for one of those photographers to get a picture of him. They'd run it up in the papers with a caption like, In Castle Rock, the intensive investigation goes on. And we'd all be out sweeping streets. Bannerman led Johnny into his private office. The desk was awash in paperwork. On the windowsill was a triptych showing Bannerman, his wife, and his daughter, Katrina. His degree hung neatly framed on the wall, and beside it, in another frame, the front page of the Castle Rock Call, which had announced his election. Coffee? Bannerman asked him, unlocking a file cabinet. No thanks, I'll stick to tea. Mrs. Sugarman guards her tea jealously, Bannerman said. Takes it home with her every day, sorry. I'd offer you a tonic, but we'd have to run the gauntlet out there again to get to the machine. Jesus Christ, I wish they'd go home. That's okay. Bannerman came back with a small clasp envelope. This is it, he said. He hesitated for a moment, then handed the envelope over. Johnny held it, but did not immediately open it. As long as you understand that nothing comes guaranteed, I can't promise. Sometimes I can, and sometimes I can't. Bannerman shrugged tiredly and repeated, No venture, no gain. Johnny undid the clasp and shook an empty Marlboro cigarette box out into his hand. Red and white box. He held it in his left hand and looked at the far wall. Gray wall. Industrial gray wall. Red and white box. Industrial gray box. He put the cigarette package in his other hand,
then cupped it in both. He waited for something, anything to come. Nothing did. He held it longer, hoping against hope, ignoring the knowledge that when things came, they came at once. At last, he handed the cigarette box back. "I'm sorry," he said.
"No soap, huh?"
"No." There was a perfunctory tap at the door, and Roscoe Fisher stuck his head in. He looked a bit shamefaced.
"Frank and I are going home, George. I guess you caught me cooping." "As long as I don't catch you doing it in your cruiser," Bannerman said. "Say hi to Deanie for me."
"You bet." Fisher glanced at Johnny for a moment, and then closed the door.
"Well," Bannerman said, "it was worth a try, I guess. I'll run you back."
"I want to go over to the common," Johnny said abruptly.
"No, that's no good. It's under a foot of snow."
"You can find the place, can't you?"
"Of course I can. Well, what'll it gain?"
"I don't know, but let's go across."
"Those reporters are going to follow us, Johnny, just as sure as God made little fishes."
"You said something about a back door?"
"Yeah, but it's a fire door. Getting in that way is okay, but if we use it to go out, the alarm goes off."
Johnny whistled through his teeth. "Let them follow along, then." Bannerman looked at him thoughtfully for several moments, and then nodded. "Okay." 8. When they came out of the office, the reporters were up and surrounding them immediately. Johnny was reminded of a run-down kennel over in Durham, where a strange old woman kept collies. The dogs would all run out at you when you went past with your fishing pole, yapping and snarling and generally scaring the hell out of you. They would nip, but not actually bite.
"Do you know who did it, Johnny? Have any ideas at all? Got any brainwaves, Mr. Smith?"
"Sheriff, was calling in a psychic your idea?"
"Do the state police and the AG's office know about this development, Sheriff Bannerman? Do you think you could break the case, Johnny?"
"Sheriff, have you deputized this guy?"
Bannerman pushed his way slowly and solidly through them, zipping his coat.
"No comment, no comment."
Johnny said nothing at all. The reporters clustered in the foyer as Johnny and Bannerman went down the snowy steps. It wasn't until they bypassed the cruiser and began wading across the street that one of them realized they were going to the common. Several of them ran back for their topcoats. Those who had been dressed for outside when Bannerman and Johnny emerged from the office now floundered down the town office steps after them, calling like children. 9. Flashlights bobbing in the snowy dark. The wind howled, blowing snow past them this way and that in errant sheets.
"You're not going to be able to see a damn thing," Bannerman said. "You will. Holy shit!"
He was almost knocked off his feet as a reporter in a bulky overcoat and a bizarre tam-o'-shanter sprawled into him.
"Sorry, Sheriff," he said sheepishly. "Slippery. Forgot my galoshes."
Up ahead, a yellow length of nylon rope appeared out of the gloom. Attached to it was a wildly swinging sign reading, "Police Investigation."
"You forgot your brains, too," Bannerman said. "Now you keep back, all of you. Keep right back."
"Town Common's public property, Sheriff," one of the reporters cried.
"That's right, and this is police business. You stay behind this rope here, or you'll spend the night in my holding cell."
With the beam of his flashlight, he traced the course of the rope for them, and then held it up so Johnny could pass beneath. They walked down the slope toward the snow-mounded shapes of the benches. Behind them, the reporters gathered at the rope, pooling their few lights so that Johnny and George Bannerman walked in a dull sort of spotlight.
"Flying blind," Bannerman said.
"Well, there's nothing to see anyway," Johnny said. "Is there?"
"No, not now. I told Frank he could take the rope down any time. Now I'm glad he didn't get around to it. You want to go over to the bandstand?"
"Not yet. Show me where the cigarette butts were."
They went on a little farther, and then Bannerman stopped.
"Here," he said, and shone his light on a bench that was little more than a vague hump poking out of a drift. Johnny took off his gloves and put them in his coat pockets. Then he knelt and began to brush the snow away from the seat of the bench. Again, Bannerman was struck by the haggard pallor of the man's face. On his knees before the bench, he looked like a religious penitent, a man in desperate prayer. Johnny's hands went cold, then mostly numb. Melted snow ran off his fingers. He got down to the splintered, weather-beaten surface of the bench. He seemed to see it very clearly, almost with magnifying power. It had once been green, but now much of the paint had flaked and eroded away. Two rusted steel bolts held the seat to the backrest. He seized the bench in both hands, and sudden weirdness flooded him. He had felt nothing so intense before, and would feel something so intense only once ever again. He stared down at the bench, frowning, gripping it tightly in his hands. It was a summer bench. How many hundreds of different people had sat here at one time or another, listening to God Bless America, to Stars and Stripes Forever. Be kind to your web-footed friends, for a duck may be somebody's mother. To the Castle Rock Cougars fight song. Green summer leaves, smoky haze of fall like a memory of corn husks, and men with rakes in mellow dusk. The thud of the big snare drum, mellow gold trumpets and trombones, school band uniforms. For a duck may be somebody's mother. Good summer people sitting here, listening, applauding, holding programs that had been designed and printed in the Castle Rock High School graphic arts shop. But this morning, a killer had been sitting here. Johnny could feel him. Dark tree branches etched against the gray snow sky like runes. I am sitting here, smoking, waiting, feeling good, feeling like I could jump right over the roof of the world and land lightly on 2 feet, humming a song, something by the Rolling Stones. Can't get that, but very clearly everything is what? All right. Everything is all right. Everything is gray and waiting for snow. And I'm slick, Johnny muttered. I'm slick. I'm so slick. Bannerman leaned forward, unable to catch the words over the howling wind. What? Slick, Johnny repeated. He looked up at Bannerman, and the sheriff involuntarily took a step backward. Johnny's eyes were cool and somehow inhuman. His dark hair blew wildly around his white face, and overhead, the winter wind screamed through the black sky. His hand seemed welded to the bench. I'm so fucking slick, he said clearly. A triumphant smile had formed on his lips. His eyes stared through Bannerman. Bannerman believed. No one could be acting this or putting it on. And the most terrible part of it was, he was reminded of someone. The smile, the tone of voice. Johnny Smith was gone. He seemed to have been replaced by a human blank. And lurking behind the planes of his ordinary features, almost near enough to touch, was another face. The face of the killer. The face of someone he knew. Never catch me, because I'm too slick for you. A little laugh escaped him, confident, lightly taunting. I put it on every time, and if they scratch or bite, they don't get a bit of me. Because I'm so slick! His voice rose in a triumphant, crazy shriek that competed with the wind, and Bannerman fell back another step, his flesh crawling helplessly, his balls tight and cringing against his guts. Let it stop, he thought. Let it stop now, please. Johnny bent his head over the bench. Melting snow dripped between his bare fingers. Snow.
Silent snow. Secret snow. She put a clothespin on it so I'd know how it felt. How it felt when you got a disease. A disease from one of those nasty fuckers. They're all nasty fuckers. And they have to be stopped. Yes, stopped. Stop them. Stop. The stop. The stop! Oh my God, the stop sign! He was little again, going to school through the silent, secret snow. And there was a man looming out of the shifting whiteness. A terrible man. A terrible black grinning man with eyes as shiny as quarters. And there was a red stop sign clutched in one gloved hand. Him. 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 Oh my God, don't. Don't let him get me. Mama, don't let him get me. Johnny screamed and fell away from the bench, his hands suddenly pressed to his cheeks. Bannerman crouched beside him, badly frightened. Behind the rope, the reporter stirred and murmured. Johnny, snap out of it. Listen, Johnny. Slick, Johnny muttered. He looked up at Bannerman with hurt, frightened eyes. In his mind, he still saw that black shape with the shiny quarter eyes looming out of the snow. His crotch throbbed dully from the pain of the clothespin the killer's mother had made him wear. He hadn't been a killer then. Oh no, not an animal. Not a puss bag or a shit bag or whatever Bannerman had called him. He'd only been a scared little boy with a clothespin on his... Help me get up, he muttered. Bannerman helped him to his feet. The bandstand now, Johnny said. No, I think we ought to go back, Johnny. Johnny pushed past him blindly and began to flounder toward the bandstand, a big circular shadow up ahead. It bulked and loomed in the darkness, the death place. Bannerman ran and caught up to him. Johnny, who is it? Do you know who? He never found any scraps of tissue under their fingernails because he was wearing a raincoat, Johnny said. He panted the words out. A raincoat with a hood. A slick vinyl raincoat.